displayed clusters of a fluffy grey in the dusk, the ghost of purple. A moist young moon hung above the mist of a neighbouring meadow. In many a garden have I stood thus in later years, in Athens, on Thebe, Atlanta, but never have I waited with such a keen desire as before those darkening lilacs. And suddenly it would come, the low buzz passing from flower to flower, the vibrational halo around the streamlined body of an olive and pink hummingbird moth, poised in the air above the corolla into which it had dipped its long tongue. Its handsome black larva, resembling a diminutive cobra when it puffed out its osculated front segments, could be found on dank willow herb 2 months later. Thus, every hour and season had its delights.
Sophia and her grandmother collect, name, and also arrange their bones, making a magical graveyard in a corner of the island.
Sophia and grandmother carried everything they found to the magic forest. They would usually go at sundown. They decorated the ground under the trees with bone arabesques like ideographs, and when they finished their patterns, they would sit for a while and talk and listen to the movements of the birds in the thicket. One morning, Sophia found a perfect skull of some large animal, found it all by herself. Grandmother thought it was a seal skull. They hid it in a basket and waited all day until evening. The sunset was in different shades of red, and the light flooded in over the whole island so that even the ground turned scarlet. They put the skull in the magic forest, and it lay on the ground and gleamed with all its teeth.
It's only a small step from curating bones to creating art. On their island, Grandmother and Sophia make a model of Venice in a marsh, whittle, sculpt, paint, and make, in their talk, the book itself. Nabokov's Speak Memory remembers a far grander location, and his prose is grander too, but he recounts the same relationship to the vision of the child and to art. On his dacha, in a storm, he writes his first poem.
Beyond the park, above steaming fields, a rainbow slipped into view. The fields ended in the notched, dark border of a remote fir wood. Part of the rainbow went across it, and that section of the forest edge shimmered most magically through the pale green and pink of the iridescent veil drawn before it. A tenderness and a glory that made poor relatives of the rhomboidal coloured reflections which the return of the sun had brought forth on the pavilion floor. A moment later, my first poem began. What touched it off? I think I know. Without any wind blowing, the sheer weight of a raindrop, shining in parasitic luxury on a chordate leaf, caused its tip to dip, and what looked like a globule of quicksilver performed a sudden glissando down the centre vein, and then, having shed its bright load, the relieved leaf unbent. Tip, leaf, dip, relief. The instant it all took to happen seemed to me not so much a fraction of time as a fissure in it, a missed heartbeat which was refunded at once by a patter of rhymes. I say patter intentionally, for when a gust of wind did come, the trees would briskly start to drip all together in as crude an imitation of the recent downpour as if the stanza I was already muttering resembled the shock of wonder I had experienced, when for a moment heart and leaf had been one.
The heart and leaf are one in the vision of the child. In The Summer Book, the visions of sea and sky, flower and bone, run through the book like motifs in music, now seen from the child's view, now from the grandmother's, but united in their sight, the Stuga on the island, in the arc of the summer and the arc of the book. Visiting the summer house each year, opening its shutters, stocking its woodpile, relighting the stove and pulling down the summer quilts for the beds, reconnects the artist with that particular and particularly northern vision. That's why Sibelius and Grieg wanted sumahus, not townhouses, why they felt close to their countries and their country's myths in their wooden walls. Another Finland-Swedish writer, the poet Justa Ågren, expressed a similar vision and longing in a short poem about his childhood in Ostrobothnia, the remote and strange region of Ireland in the northern Baltic. In a heat haze, cows approach, huge and mysterious. They tower over the child, then disappear, and at once the poem drops into the past tense. There is a world of longing in the long notes of another word we can't quite translate from the Swedish, however close the linguistic links. Zumma. Zumma. Because even if you grow up in Scotland, you can't come near the longing for light you experience in the Scandinavian winter, nor the glory of the endless day of the midsummer when it finally comes, and you're waiting on your mokki, or storga, or dacha, to receive it.
Childhood summer. Through the slow shadows the cows approach, warm evening mothers that rather stay than go. Their eyes are great flowers, their bodies are full of grass. Almost plants they are, groping their way home on gently walking roots. It was summer. Summer.
Childhood Summer by Justa Ågren. Closing the Door of the Summer House, which was written and presented by Kate Clanchy. The readers were Sam Dale and Sally Orrick, and the producer was Julian May. And in the second interval of this evening's Nordic Prom, Andrew Sachs reads The Hot House by Finnish writer and creator of the Moomins, Tuve Jansson. Well, here in the Royal Albert Hall and live on BBC Radio 3, we're about to encounter the centrepiece of this evening's prom and the work around which it's been assembled by conductor Thomas Dausgaard, The Music of the Spheres from 1918 by Danish composer Ruth Langor, who I've seen described as an ecstatic outsider. A pretty neat summary. If you're completely new to Langor, then here are the basics. Born in Copenhagen in 1893, he gave organ recitals from the age of 11 and in 1913 had his first symphony performed in an all-Langor concert by the Berlin Philharmonic. He was just 19 and you'd have predicted a glittering career. Instead, the deeply religious and eccentrically dressed composer found himself increasingly out of step with mainstream musical society, barely making a living until he became cathedral organist in Ribe in West Jutland, about as far as you can get from Denmark's cultural heart. Langor died in 1952 and left a huge amount of music behind him, over 400 works, including 16 symphonies and his only opera, Antichrist. And when you discover some of the music's unpredictable and highly original qualities, you can find your grip on 20th century musical history loosening, as Langor seems to anticipate the sounds of the 60s, the 70s, even the 80s by a good few decades. So, does Thomas Dausgaard remember the first time he encountered Langor's music?
Yeah, very well, because I was sitting in on a rehearsal with the Danish Radio Symphony Orchestra as a teenager, and they were rehearsing Symphony No. 6. And it struck me as bizarre, very strange, and yet extremely fascinating. There was an inner power and a kind of expression which was beyond what we have as standard fare in our musical culture. And I think the Music of the Spheres falls into the same category. It's just of a larger-than-life-like vision.
How would you actually introduce the work to somebody who hasn't even come across Langor before? Because what we're going to hear is so extraordinary, and he makes some very peculiar demands on the players and the singers, doesn't he?
Yeah, it is a kind of series of tableau. You go from one picture to the next. Each mood is presented on its own without a bridge going into it or a bridge going out of it. So within each mood, you are in a sort of timeless frame. The groups of the orchestra don't necessarily interact. They move independently of each other. And I think that's a really important part of the work because the work describes the time of Antichrist in Langard's mind, the time before doomsday, before things are put right, the time where everything is on its head. And therefore, we don't speak to each other. We just speak independently of each other. Therefore, the groups of the orchestra don't speak to each other. They go each their own way. And there's something very absurd about it. But there's also something very spacious and timeless about it, which is made extremely clear in one instance towards the end, where the orchestra is asked to play for 1 minute. It's an indication of moving out in space, moving away from the time as we know it, because 1 minute, that's a pretty long time when you just hear the same note repeated.
And what about the space of the Royal Albert Hall? How did it actually feel to you in rehearsal?
Well, I was so excited about going to do it here. And it's a challenge for every space, but I think it is perfectly suited for the Albert Hall. I've just been so excited about the prospect of being able to put the small chamber orchestra, which is an offstage orchestra, up in the gallery, and to put the final chorus, which is an angelic chorus. It is Resolve after the 1 minute of Hell, and to put them in the gallery as well. It is, I think, ideal space for this.
Danish National Symphony Orchestra's conductor Thomas Dausgaard, and the only person he didn't mention was the offstage soprano soloist Inger Dam Jensen, who's up in the gallery. And before we hear the wall of sound that is Langor's Music of the Spheres, his Amara George Ligeti's Lux Aeterna from 1966 shows us another magical vision of darkness and light, a shimmering polytonal texture that could almost have come from Langor's world.
Thank you.
heavenly radiance after an apocalyptic struggle between the forces of darkness and light. The Music of the Spheres by Danish composer Ruth Langgaard. And by the way, what you heard at the end there was the strumming of what Langgaard calls glissando piano, an upright with the front removed so that the strings can be brushed instead of hammered. And you just heard the first UK concert performance given by the Danish National Concert Choir and Danish National Vocal Ensemble, both on and off stage, with soprano soloist Inger Dam Jensen in the gallery at the very back of the Royal Albert Hall alongside the small offstage band and the Danish National Symphony Orchestra conducted by Thomas Dausgaard. Returning now to the platform with the chorus master Florian Helgath and gesturing to the very far reaches of the hall, the gallery, where Inger Dam Jensen and the offstage band can just be seen in the distance taking their share of the applause. In many ways, it's the Music of the Spheres which helped spark a new interest in Langgaard's music 46 years after its 1921 premiere. That applause for the four timpanists ranged across the back of the stage, and then the eight horn players that Langgaard asks for. Well, the Danish composer Per Nørgaard was so intrigued by what he'd seen in the score that he slipped it amongst a pile of new works being considered for performance at the Nordic Music Days in 1968. And Nørgaard's fellow juror, George Ligeti, was startled by what he saw. "I've just realised that I'm a Langgaard imitator," he exclaimed after recognising some of the same techniques he'd been pioneering in his own music in a score written almost half a century earlier. And we heard some of those same effects from Ligeti's own choral soundscape, Lux Aeterna, before the Music of the Spheres, a prayer for eternal light from the Requiem Mass. The organist, Per Salem, made the most of the Royal Albert Hall's magnificent instrument as part of that performance. The orchestra tuned down just a touch to meet at their regular concert pitch is a fraction above the 440 hertz to which the organ's tuned. We had a curtain call a moment ago for principal flautist Ulla Milman, lovely solo in the middle of the work. And Thomas Dausgaard brings the entire band to its feet again. Solo as well from Danish National Symphony Orchestra's leader Christina Aarstrand. They've been ambassadors for Langgaard's music for quite a while now, not just in the concert hall and on air, but on disc. They recorded the complete Langgaard symphonies, and they released the Music of the Spheres with the same cast just last week. Well, in the last part of this evening's prompt, Thomas Dausgaard puts Langgaard's Music of the Spheres into its contemporary context with a more celebrated Nordic work written around the same time, Sibelius's Symphony No. 5. In this second interval, Andrew Sachs reads The Hot House by another famous Finn, the writer Tuva Jansson, creator of The Moomins. Two elderly eccentrics strike up an unlikely friendship when they tussle over a bench in a Finnish botanical garden.
When Uncle was really old, he developed an interest in botany. He never married, but his benevolent extended family always took good care of him. Now his relatives bought him some beautifully illustrated books on botany. Uncle praised the books and set them aside. But when they'd all gone off to their jobs and their schools, he would take the tram to the botanical gardens. It was a laborious journey, but the awkwardness of the enterprise was more than compensated by anticipation, and by the crucial moment when he opened the door to the hothouse and was met by the warmth and the powerful scent of the flowers and the silence. There was rarely anyone there. Uncle would put off looking at the water lily pond. That always had to come last. He would wander down the narrow passages through tropical greenery. Just occasionally, he felt an irrational desire to walk straight into the flowering luxuriance, to feel it rather than just look at it. This dangerous desire became even stronger when he came near the water lily, the lotus pond. What would it be like to take off his shoes and stride in, wading among the broad-leaved flowers, letting them come together again behind him as though nothing had happened, entirely alone in the hothouse. Near the water was a wrought-iron bench where Uncle liked to rest his legs and lose himself in a kind of contemplation that gradually freed him from all the concerns of the outside world. High above the pond rose a glass cupola. The bridge beneath the cupola was a delicate tracery of fin de siècle metal arabesques, and the spiral staircase up to it had the same playfully seductive elegance. Sometimes people clunked up the staircase and crossed the bridge quickly before coming down again and disappearing. They were always in a hurry, and hardly ever gave the lily pond a glance. Donkeys, thought Uncle. Strong legs, but no brains. One day, when Uncle came, he found the bench already occupied by an old gentleman with a drooping moustache. Uncle walked on through the green corridors, and when he felt tired, came back to the pond, but the bench was still occupied. After waiting a little, he went home. Next time, the same man was sitting on Uncle's bench, and now he had a book. He didn't even glance at the water lilies. He just read. Uncle was so annoyed that he went to the caretaker and spoke to him for the first time ever. Who's that? Does he come here often? Oh, yes, said the caretaker. Recently he's been coming every day. Oh, I'm so sorry. And so it went. Every day when Uncle came to the hothouse, he would find the old man sitting there, right in the middle of the bench once more. This individual was bound to be a talkative type, and he looked so extremely old that there could be no doubt he must be very lonely. One day it was even worse. When it was time to go home, the old man got up to leave at exactly the same moment. The bench was now free, but it was too late. Uncle tried to escape, but the other was surprisingly quick on his legs, and both gentlemen reached the double door of the main entrance at the same time. And the old devil held the door open for Uncle and stood and waited. Ah, it was the caretaker who saved the day. He hurried over, politely opened the other half of the door and bowed. The two visitors passed out side by side and turned firmly in opposite directions. The problem became almost an obsession. Uncle began to see the other man as a personal enemy. Finally, one winter's day, the bench was empty again. Uncle sat down quickly and gazed at the lily pond, so long absent from his meditations. But his sense of peace was gone. He could think of nothing but the other man. And then the door opened, and in he came. His stick tapped steadily on the floor to the bench, then struck the floor twice. "You're sitting on my bench." It would have been childish to say, "No, it's mine." He must be neither hostile nor submissive. After a desperate search for words, he finally said, "My dear sir, I'm as deaf as a post." His enemy sighed, it seemed with relief, found room beside Uncle, and opened his book. The only other sound in the hothouse was the babbling water. As soon as it was clear to Uncle that he wouldn't have to talk, his hostility gave way to a kind of unwilling respect. He had discovered that the book was Spinoza, and that increased his esteem. He decided to bring a book himself, to make an impression, and next day opened a bulky botanical work his family had given him. But the book was too cumbersome to hold in his lap, and the print was much too small. Now and then, the man sitting beside Uncle would repeat in an undertone some phrase that appealed to him or disturbed him in his book, though on one occasion he clearly said with contempt, "He knows nothing about flowers, he's just pretending." This upset Uncle so badly that he threw caution to the winds, stood up and shouted, "You're the one who doesn't know a damn thing about flowers. You never even look at them." "Astonishing," said his neighbour. He studied Uncle with a certain interest. "If I understand correctly, you are also a man who values silence. And my name is Josephson." "Westerberg," said Uncle crossly. "And now," continued Josephson, "perhaps we can leave one another in peace, or join one another in peace." This was how their relationship began, grimly and with few words. It gradually emerged that Josephson lived in a noisy place called Peaceful Haven, full of tiresome old gentlemen who wanted to talk. He mentioned this in passing and without comment. Uncle stopped bringing his botanical book with him. Now the tranquillity of the hothouse was once again a place of meditation and peace. Funnily enough, an even greater peace than in the days when he'd had the bench to himself. Then suddenly, Yusufsson vanished. He didn't come to the hothouse for a whole week. Uncle spoke to the caretaker, who knew nothing. Maybe Yusufsson's ill, thought Uncle. I must find out. The caretaker helped him find Peaceful Haven in the phone book. Peaceful Haven seemed quite dreadful to Uncle. He had never even imagined so much anxious old age gathered together in one place. At home, everyone else was much younger, so he was naturally an exception, unique. But here, he felt himself absorbed into a compact, anonymous mass. Someone showed him to Yusufsson's room. Yusufsson was lying in bed with the covers pulled up to his chin. "Ah, Westerberg, I'm so grateful that you haven't brought flowers. In any case, I'm not ill. Just bored stiff." "The caretaker sends his greetings," said Uncle, looking for somewhere to sit. Both chairs in the room were piled high with books. "Just put them on the floor," said Yusufsson impatiently. "I'm tired of them. Nothing but words, all of them. They don't help. They're not enough." After a pause, he continued, almost to himself, "Westerberg, you don't understand what a great gift you've been given. Go on gazing at your blessed lotus blossoms. Go on looking at them, so long as there's time to look. And be grateful you've never felt any need to struggle towards an idea. I mean, search for something worth believing in and defending."
"Well, I did once defend a meadow," Uncle began, but Yusufsson wasn't listening.
"In this place," said Yusufsson, "time is just something that passes. It is no longer alive, any more than it is in those books. What I need is a clear picture, and I haven't much time. A clear picture of what I've wanted and tried to do, and what came of it all, and what really matters. It's important, searching out something that might have real meaning, some sort of answer, an ultimate, valid conclusion. Do you know what I mean?"
"Not really. But in the end, does all that really matter, if all it does is upset you? And surely it's no more urgent now than it was before."
Yusufsson started to laugh.
"Westerberg, there's something very likeable about you. But you really are a great big donkey, aren't you?"
"Yes, of course," said Uncle. "But you will come back to the hothouse, won't you?"
"Oh, yes, 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 I'll come when I come. But for the moment, I shan't say another word. Not a single sensible word."
On his way home on the tram, Uncle didn't think much about what had been said in this undoubtedly very meaningful, if somewhat incomprehensible, conversation. "I must tell him about that meadow sometime," he thought. The year before Uncle met Yusufsson, his relatives had hired a summer cottage on a skerry near the coast. The most characteristic feature of the island was a deep ravine cutting across it from west to east. The fishermen from whom they rented it had bridged the ravine with scrap wood so he wouldn't have to climb down to the meadow by the shore if he wanted to get from the dock to the cottage. The first time Uncle climbed the hill, he suddenly stopped abruptly. He'd caught sight of the meadow, which now, in July, was in full bloom, with the lightly and airily fluttering colours of all the different flowers. He could see that no one had crossed the meadow. It was as untouched as on that first morning in paradise, and he thought it even more beautiful than the hothouse. He decreed that no one should disturb the meadow. It was only to be seen. Every day, just before dawn, Uncle slithered down the hillside to sit in a corner of his meadow. It was at its most beautiful at the moment when the sun rose above the horizon. Then, just for a short time, the colours would glow with an almost unearthly translucency. What a sight! Uncle was not being unfaithful to the hothouse. It was just that what is constantly changing is superior to what is static. And the meadow was full of life.
Sometimes he felt the same dangerous desire he experienced in the hothouse, as if his sense of wonder entitled him to walk right in and feel the meadow around him. But he held back. Then, one fine day, his relations decided to erect a tent sauna. Even the smallest cottage in Finland must have its sauna. Now, a tent sauna must be set up on level ground, and the only level ground on the island was Uncle's meadow. Some difficult days followed, with strong words and long silences. But, as so often happens in families, a compromise was reached. The sauna would be built under the bridge, very discreetly and with the least possible disturbance to the meadow. Once they had erected their sauna under the bridge and gone away, Uncle came to have a look. It was a square monstrosity, with a metal chimney, a misshapen intrusion on the landscape. Inside, it was dim, with broad wooden planks for benches. A utilitarian, private place. Uncle sat down on the lowest bench. This caused the opening of the tent to frame his meadow, so that suddenly it resembled a painting. He almost felt he'd painted it himself. No one was surprised when Uncle said he would like to sleep in the sauna. They fixed it up for him and carried down every imaginable thing he might want. It was nice living under the bridge in between its strong supporting pillars. Then, one night at the end of July, the wind rose and high water swept through the ravine. He woke up to find himself on a wet mattress, not quite sure where he was. The tent fluttered and slapped, and it was too hot, as hot and damp as inside the hothouse, like a storm over the lily pond. Uncle waded out into the wet night, fascinated. Outside it was lighter. He could make out the glass cupola. It was much higher than usual, and the spiral staircase had vanished. The meadow billowed anxiously to and fro around him as he stumbled on. Yes, now at last he could embrace the meadow, walk straight into the lotus pond, feel soft elastic soil under his bare feet and the gentle touch of water lilies. And he could understand the hitherto unimaginable battle of innocent flowers against an aggressive sea. He was alone, free to possess what he loved, calm and untroubled. Gradually, he made his way up to the cottage and fell asleep. So he didn't see the tent sauna carried off at dawn. He didn't see the bridge bulge and break, the splintered wood tossed high and swept aside by the angry sea. A bit of the bridge caught fast in a crevice on the far side of the island and was chopped up for firewood. It would all be made useful one way or another. The family built a new bridge across the ravine. In Uncle's opinion, an eyesore. It wasn't a proper bridge, but looked more like a level crossing on a railway. The old bridge had been weathered by sun and salt water and had taken on the colours of the hillside. It had become a natural part of the structure of the island. But Uncle said nothing, because they were all so proud of the mess they had made. The meadow did not recover from the night of the storm, but he knew that next July it would be just as beautiful as before. And they'd done battle against the sea, he and the meadow together. One day, Uncle noticed their firewood was grey and full of nails, lumber from the old bridge. He chose some suitable pieces and found the tools he needed. Slowly, with great care, he began to make a tiny copy of the old bridge. When Uncle visited the hothouse after his visit to Peaceful Haven, Yusufson was back on his old perch. He put down his book and said, "Well, Vesterberg, you old hedonist, good to see you. As you see, I'm still searching for some sort of logic that makes sense." He made room on the bench and went on reading. Uncle sat down on his own side, the left. It was nice to have Yusufson back. Uncle thought about telling him about the meadow and the storm, but the time didn't seem right. So he just sat gazing at the beautiful lily pond. They continued coming to the hothouse, though not so often as before. The caretaker, who used to sit behind the bush with his crochet work, had retired. The new one, who didn't know them, would pass right in front of their bench with no sign of respect or recognition. Yusufson seemed perfectly happy to be left in silence, occasionally exchanging the odd word, underlining a sentence in his book. Every time Uncle let the silence stretch out, he grew more uneasy and annoyed. He'd begun to bring the model bridge with him, but it became harder and harder to show it and tell the story of the storm. He simply couldn't do it. The night when he embraced the meadow was slipping away from him, and Yusufson was no help at all. Then one day, as they were sitting as usual, a furious thunderstorm blew in over the city. A heavy squall threw open the hothouse doors. There was a crash of glass, and the storm burst in, making waves in the lily pond. Tiny waves, but waves nonetheless. Uncle stood up, walked forward, and waded straight into the pool, shoving aside leaves and lilies regardless, then turned and called out, "Yusufson, do you see what I'm doing?"
"Too good," said Yusufson, putting down his book. "Keep going. Very stimulating."
Later, they sat together till closing time. The storm had gradually subsided, and the caretaker calmed down too. Uncle talked about the meadow, and talked very well. Yusufson was a better listener than he could have expected. Uncle showed him the little bridge. He looked at Uncle and said,
"Yes, yes, I understand. The essence of the meadow. See, admire, experience, all that. And the bridge. What's the point of a bridge that doesn't lead anywhere?"
"What, it doesn't mean anything," said Uncle angrily. "A bridge is a bridge. It's a bridge. Just a bridge." "Here you are again trying to find meaning in something that's just obvious in itself. Where it goes and where it comes from doesn't matter. You just go over it, and that's all there is to it." The caretaker came over and suggested that Uncle go home before he caught cold. "We're having a conversation," said Uncle. "Yusufson, have you reached any conclusion? Have you found anything important in those books?"
"Oh, this and that," said Yusufson, smiling. "It takes time, but I always knew it would. It looks as if neither of us will ever convince the other. But do we need to?"
"No," said Uncle. "The other person only needs to listen and understand."
"I can accept that," said Yusufson. "I like that part about the meadow."
Uncle said, "Yes, I do think I told it rather well." They stood up together and went out through the hothouse's storm-shattered doors, and after a friendly word, separated, and each made his own way home.
Andrew Sachs was reading The Hot House by Tuva Jansson. The story was translated by Sylvester Mazzarella and abridged and produced by Gemma Jenkins. And back in the Royal Albert Hall for the third part of this evening's Prom, live here on BBC Radio 3, we're about to enjoy the fruits of a Finnish struggle for composer Jean Sibelius, his Symphony No. 5, commissioned by the Finnish government in honour of Sibelius's 50th birthday. And he conducted the first performance himself on that very occasion, the 8th of December 1915. But he wasn't completely happy with it, and over the next 4 years he revised it, and it was performed in two further versions, ending up with the Fifth Symphony as we know it today. "I wish to give my symphony another more human form," he said, "more down-to-earth, more vivid." The Danish National Symphony Orchestra's conductor Thomas Dausgaard chose the Sibelius for this programme of associations, as he calls it, as it was being completed and then rewritten at exactly the same time as the centrepiece of the Prom, Ruth Langor's The Music of the Spheres. But does Thomas Dausgaard find they have anything in common?
"I think what I experienced performing the Langard piece is that in spite of this being in distinct tableaus, separate pictures, there is a kind of undercurrent which is very strong. There is a tension going through from beginning to end, which, although it is in a completely different way from the Sibelius, somehow resembles the inner power of the Sibelius. In the Sibelius, we find it's, in a way, more obvious. It's a more obvious pull going through to the end. But somehow I found in performance that there is a similar strength within them, which takes us right through to the last note. Apart from that, it's all much more organic the way it unfolds in Sibelius. I also think that there's a strong element in Sibelius's music which has to do with timelessness, or the longing for timelessness. And in that way, I think, though they approach it very differently, I think they have something very strong in common. And I think it must have something to do with what many of us long for, being one with nature, forgetting about time, being very much in the moment. And you know from descriptions of Sibelius's joy of nature that he could really get quite ecstatic about what he experienced, whether it was a snowflake or birds crossing the sky. So there's something about this awe for nature and this longing for being one with nature, which I think goes through the music we play tonight.
Thomas Dalsgaard. And by the time of the Fifth Symphony, Sibelius was comparing the process of composition to the rearrangement of thematic ideas. It's as if God had thrown down the tiles of a mosaic from heaven's floor and asked me to determine what kind of picture it was. And in the case of the Fifth, Sibelius didn't find the right pattern until he'd gone through those 4 years of revision and 3 separate versions. Yet it feels so well integrated, so thought through, it's hard to believe that it's all the result of shuffling his stack of compositional tiles. The end result is a compact 3-movement structure with a particularly inventive first movement which grows from the opening horn call and accelerates to its exhilarating conclusion. And here to conduct the Danish National Symphony Orchestra in Sibelius' Symphony No. 5 is the orchestra's principal conductor and deviser of this evening's prom, Thomas Dalsgaard.
Thank you.
the rugged, exultant ending of Sibelius's Symphony No. 5 in E flat. Played for us at this evening's prom by the Danish National Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Thomas Dausgaard. And it's one of the world's oldest radio orchestras, formed when the Danish Broadcasting Corporation was launched in 1925. Thomas Dausgaard charging back into the middle of the orchestra to give all the winds their moment of glory, their time in the spotlight, and the four horn players of the Danish National Symphony Orchestra. The rest of the brass following them to their feet, the cheers from the promenaders. Well, the orchestra's manager was telling me it began basically as a chamber group for broadcasts only, no public concerts, and just grew from there. And these days, there's a core of 99 musicians. It's based in its glamorous new concert hall in Copenhagen, opened just last year, designed by French architect Jean Nouvelne. If you see pictures of it, it's a kind of beautiful blue-screened translucent box containing the main concert hall, suspended, I was told earlier, like a meteorite from space. And Christina Ostrand, the orchestra's leader, was telling me how their sound's changed and continues to evolve since they've moved into the new hall. Now, she says, they can really hear each other and there's really no hiding place, so it's exciting and also a little frightening at the same time. And they can also see each other much better thanks to the way they're seated, she said, as in a Greek amphitheatre with the audience all around them. Here comes Thomas Dausgaard once again, bowing to the promenaders. I think there'll be an encore. A little more Sibelius, Ariel's Song, from his Music for the Tempest. A nice gesture from the Danes, combining Nordic music with a reference to British culture and Shakespeare. But what next? The Danish National Symphony Orchestra gets a break. Thomas Dausgaard's off to rehearse with his other ensemble, the Swedish Chamber Orchestra, before he takes them round the festival circuit and brings them to the proms on the 23rd of August for some Schumann and Berlioz. If you've enjoyed this programme, it's something they tried at home at the weekend, an open rehearsal with an invited audience. And more music, stand by. Corks popping from within the percussion section there. That was the Champagne Gallop by Hans Christian Lumbu, the man they called the Strauss of the North, composer of waltzes, polkas and gallops. Although I gather if you're Danish, Johann Strauss the Younger is the Lumbu of the South. The Danish National Symphony Orchestra conducted by Thomas Dausgaard, a rousing finale to their prom this evening. Tomorrow's prom offers the Berlioz Overture, Chopin's second piano concerto with Nelson Freire, Roussel's Third Symphony and Ravel's Daphnis and Chloe with the BBC Symphony Orchestra and young French conductor Lionel Brangier. But as the Danes head home with the applause of the promenaders ringing in their ears and the music of the Spheres and Sibelius's Call of the Wild still ringing in ours, back in Broadcasting House, here's John Shea.
Andrew, thank you very much. Andrew McGregor presented tonight's live prom from the Royal Albert Hall. As ever, there's another chance to hear it via the iPlayer for the next 7 days or again here on BBC Radio 3 next Monday afternoon from 2 o'clock. And if in the meantime you're tempted to submit your own online review of the concert, you can do that via the proms website, bbc.co.uk/proms, and then click on share. And I should also tell you that Sibelius's Fifth Symphony will be the subject of Discovering Music next Sunday afternoon on BBC Radio 3, beginning at 5 o'clock. Well, back to this Wednesday evening. The essay in 45 minutes continues our series looking back at the dramatic events of 1989 in Eastern Europe. The world turned upside down. That's at 11 o'clock. But before that, with the time at just after a quarter past 10, another chance to hear one of our features broadcast earlier in the year. The first permanent English settlement in Canada was established 400 years ago at Cupid's Cove. Sean Street now visits Newfoundland to explore how recent archaeological discoveries and centuries-old historical documents are together revealing its history.
We just walked along the beach, examining the eroding banks, looking for evidence of a 17th century occupation. And this is a pipe stem with quite a large bore, probably a 7 or an 8 bore in it. And that suggests a date range of 1680 or before, you know, some probably mid-17th century pipe stem.
Yeah, this is a pipe stem just
popped literally
the ground,
just found.
Just come into ground.
Just as we were just talking.
A hot July Sunday on the east coast of Newfoundland, at Cupid's Cove, once called Cooper's Cove, the head of a long, narrow inlet with just a few houses dotted along the rocky shore. Archaeologist William Gilbert is leading his team in a dig that links the old and new worlds of Europe and North America.
Even something as simple as that tells us that there were people here in the first half of the 17th century, and I guess they were smoking as well. They were having a smoke while they were here.
Did find some coarse earthenware, some bellows flint. Somebody brought it over from England.
Because it isn't native to these
shores? No. It's native to England, so it was brought over.
We're here at the site of the Cooper's Cove Plantation, which is the oldest English settlement in Canada. It was established in 1610 by a consortium of London and Bristol merchants, the London and Bristol Company of Merchant Venturers. And the first governor of this plantation site, this colony, was a Bristol merchant by the name of John Guy. And in August of 1610, John Guy and 39 colonists arrived here and began the work of building the Cooper's Cove Plantation site.
Right Worshipful, it may please you to understand that we arrived, God be praised, all in safety in the Bay of Conception, in Newfoundland, in the harbour here called Cooper's Cove. This harbour is 3 leagues distance from Collier's Bay to the northeastward, and is preferred by me to begin our plantation, for the goodness of the harbour, the fruitfulness of the soil, the largeness of the trees, and many other reasons.
We came here first in 1995, myself and my crew from the Backlew Trail Heritage Corporation, to see if we could find where within Cupid's the Cooper's Cove Plantation once stood. Before we came in and started digging holes in the ground, which is what archaeologists generally like to do, I went back to the original documents to see if I could find any evidence that would help to narrow down the location of the site. And we're really lucky in that we have a number of documents that have survived from the early days of the plantation site. There was nowhere in those documents that said the plantation is in such and such a place. But there were 3 clues in the documents that helped narrow down the location. Guy mentions that the plantation was 12 score from the lake, which is Cupid's Pond up here on the back of the hill behind the harbor. And a score is a distance of 20 paces, so 12 times 20. We knew it was 240 paces from the lake. John Guy and another colonist, Henry Kraut, both mentioned that the plantation was next to a stream, and there used to be a stream to flow just a little bit west of here. It's since been diverted. And Henry Kraut mentions in his diary that the plantation was on the landward side of the little saltwater pond here at the bottom of the harbor. So those were our three clues initially.
The English had been interested in Newfoundland since the time of Cabot. That's the end of the 15th century. So he makes a couple of voyages. And there are, in fact, some English fishing voyages in the early 16th century, sometimes in cooperation with Azorean Portuguese captains.
Peter Pope lectures in anthropology and history at Memorial University in St. John's, Newfoundland, and he's the author of Fish into Wine, a key text exploring the way of life that developed on the island in the 17th century.
By the end of the 16th century, I'm saying by, say, the 1580s, the 1590s, England's asserting itself. It's competing with Spain and with Portugal, which is part of Spain at that time. And there's increasingly cries that Newfoundland should be settled. There's a number of tracts that are published at the end of the 16th century, Anthony Parkhurst, Richard Whitburn, and so on.
The country of Newfoundland, as it is here truly described, is little inferior to any other for the commodities thereof, and lies, as it were, with open arms towards England, offering itself to be embraced and inhabited by us.
It's in that context that the London-Bristol Company funds the settlement at Cupid's. So Cupid's is a kind of a crucial step. It's the first formal colonization of Newfoundland. The settlement there survived. That is clearly the route of further settlement in Conception Bay, which by the end of the century is the most heavily settled and the richest part of Newfoundland.
We're really lucky. We have 17 letters that were written from here back to England between 1610 and 1613. And we also have Henry Kraut's diary. Henry Kraut was a colonist who arrived here first in 1612. He was from southwest Devon, somewhere around Plymouth. And he kept a diary from the 1st of September 1612 till the 13th of May 1613. In that diary, he makes a number of references to the saltwater pond. And at one point, he mentions that the saltwater pond froze over last night.
February the 10th, 1613. This morning, the little pond between the house and the brew house, and also the harbour, was all taken over with a cream of ice. This night, the wind was at west-northwest. Little wind, but freezing hard all the night.
As a result of that, we know the brew house was on the other side of the saltwater pond. And he also mentions that there was a stage before the brew house. So we know there was a stage in front of it as well.
So it all helps to build a real picture.
Yes, to bring it all together, yeah. That's a lot of what we've been doing over the past 15 years is trying to match up the documentary evidence with the archaeological evidence, the stuff that's coming out of the ground, you know. John Guy did produce a map of the plantation, but it hasn't survived, or if it has survived, we haven't found it. So what we're doing is mapping 17th century Cooper's Cove ourselves in the 21st century.
It's not the model of colonization that would typify the British Empire, say, in the 19th century or even the 18th century, the colonization of Australia. No, it's a different kind of thing.
The thinking that drove the Cupid's colonization was highly practical. Peter Pope is keen to draw a distinction between British imperialist ambition and a transatlantic mercantile impulse.
It's a business. It's this North Atlantic fish trade where Europeans come to Newfoundland in the summer. They salt and dry fish. Basically, it's an inshore fishery. There are properties on the shore, facilities constructed for processing the fish.
The first reference that we have to a load of salt fish arriving back in Europe, or at least arriving back in England, is from 1502. John Amain aboard the Gabriel sails into Bristol with a load of salt fish from Newfoundland. And there were people fishing here before that, we know that for sure.
The idea of salting fish, which is so fundamental to the history of Newfoundland's economy, is something that actually still does go on. And with me is Ray Hoskins from New Harbour. And Ray, you still do this. Could you give me a quick masterclass in the procedure?
Okay. Well, first of all, he goes out and catches the cat. We got some. Takes the heads out of them, and then we split some down through the middle, takes out what he calls the sand bone in the codfish, and just lays them out flat, puts them in salt over a period of 5 or 6 days, take it out of salt, just washes it out, and just puts it on the flake.
Well, a fish flake is a rudimentary wooden platform, usually with boughs over it, used for drying the fish. It's one of the oldest European architectural features in the New World.
And good windy days, that's the best time for drying the fish. Two or three good days on it, that's how he dries the fish.
When Guy arrived, this would have been a very busy place in the summertime. Up to 5,000 English fishermen here, 10,000 French, plus Spanish and Portuguese as well. So seasonally, this would have been a very busy place. The migratory fishery ran from May till September, late August, early September, and the rest of the year, it would have been a wilderness, basically. When Guy arrived, there was a transition from the migratory fishery to the beginning of permanent settlement.
As Bill Gilbert makes very clear, this was already a major industry. In fact, salted cod from Newfoundland can lay claim to being the very first commodified processed food. No wonder John Guy was so keen to point out to his masters in England the real value of Cupid's Cove.
Here is a good beach, and the fishing near. To be assured of a good place to fish and a beach, boats and stage may be worth more than £100 or £200 yearly, which the company may be assured of by the plantation, because they shall be sure to be the first here every year to take what stage they shall have need of for their own use.
And that means that there's a certain value to having some kind of permanent staff to take care of that, to watch over those things in the winter, partly to watch over them so that you can have the same fishing room next year. Otherwise, it's first come, first served, and partially because of a pressure created by the Beothuk, the native people of Newfoundland, who were quite interested in European fishing sites because, hey, there's all these nails there, and, you know, all you have to do is burn a boat or a fishing stage, and you can take the nails and turn them into handy tools. So there was a certain advantage to having some people overwintering, but the roots of the thing were definitely commercial. They were in the interests of that great big industry, the fish trade, which I always say it's one of the extinct dinosaurs of economic history. It's this huge thing that once existed that we've completely forgotten.
If you went any farther east from here, you're no longer near the stream and you're no longer on the landward side of the saltwater pond. So this was the only place left, really. We walked up onto the edge of the terrace here, and there'd been a big windstorm the winter before and a number of trees had blown over. And when we started to look in the dirt that was thrown up from where the trees blew over, we started finding 17th century pottery, 17th century bottle glass. So we knew we were on the edge of a 17th century site. And really, based on what the documents said, it was the only place left, you know, that where it might possibly have been. So what we did is we got permission from the landowners, and we've standard archaeological survey procedure. We ran lines east, west, north, south, and we dug holes at regular intervals along those lines. And when we did that, we found that we had an area that was about 95 feet by 170 feet within which there was 17th century material. That in itself was significant because John Guy mentions that when he came here, he enclosed an area that was 90 feet by 120 feet, and he built his first dwelling house and storehouse inside that enclosure. So, looked very positive.
From the 6th of October until the 16th of May, our company had been employed in making of a storehouse to hold our provisions and a dwelling house for our habitation, which was finished about the 1st of December, with a square enclosure of 120 foot long and 90 foot broad and a workhouse to work dry in and to make boats or any other work out of the rain.
The more work we did, the more digging we did, just everything just seemed to come together. So there can be no other interpretation as to what this is other than that it is the original plantation site from 1610. First English settlement in Canada.
Right next to the plantation site, the dig here in Cupid's, is the trailer, which is the sort of weekend and summer home of Ruth Baker. She very kindly let me come into your trailer, Ruth. And Bill has found the site here. Did it surprise you that it was right on your doorstep here?
I thought it probably was up in this part of the community, because it's a logical spot where you could just sit here and look out the harbour and see all the pirates that would come in or any boats or whatever. And, of course, I've been here from day one when Bill asked us for permission to do the test pit on our garden, because we had a potato garden there. So it was really exciting. I mean, he found a few artifacts, some pipes, and we also, of course, found a cannonball and some pottery in our garden when we'd plough the garden for our potatoes, right? And then, of course, Bill came and everything started to unfold from there.
Right here in the middle of the display case here, you see this little silver coin. Looks quite humble, but it's actually the oldest English coin ever found in Canada.
Down the road from the dig itself is the Cupid's Museum and Project Laboratory, where more than 139,000 artefacts recovered from the site are being conserved, catalogued and stored.
It's an Elizabethan silver fourpence that was minted in the Tower of London sometime between December of 1560 and October of 1561. Obviously, it's very worn. It was in circulation for quite a long time and must have fallen out of the purse of one of the early colonists who came over here from England in 1610 or 1611, who must have been really upset when they lost it because this was worth half a day's wages or more.
This part of the dig we've come to now, Bill, is an example of how the documentation can inform questions that might arise when you come to something that you don't quite understand. Mm-hmm. Because what we're looking at here, on the face of it, is a small declivity in